Much of the attention on the economy these days focuses on building back from the last financial crisis, the Great Recession. Today's guest focuses his attention on the future, and he says a potentially dire situation looms there. The title of his book of forecasts is very clear about where he stands. It's called The Death of Money, The Coming Collapse of the International Monetary System. It's written by James Rickards, who's a lawyer with a long history in the financial business, including more than three decades on Wall Street. He was general counsel at the hedge fund Long-Term Capital Management when a Fed-guided bailout saved it from disaster in 1998. James Rickards is currently a consultant on international economics and financial threats. His earlier book is Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis. Jim Rickards, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Great to be with you.
I don't want to pigeonhole you as a pessimist, but obviously the titles of your books indicate some real concerns about the world economy and where it's going.
Well, that's right. And I, you know, tell people personally I'm not a pessimist. I kind of have an optimistic personality, but I'm also an analyst, and you have to be realistic about where things are going. And you're right. And what I do is I kind of look at a combination of history and science. I think that's a good foundation. We have to recognize that there's a lot of uncertainty out there and no one has all the answers. But I think if you can put things on a scientific footing as opposed to, you know, just kind of ranting about central bankers or taking an ideological perspective and also looking at history, that's a good way to approach things. And when I talk about the coming collapse of the international monetary system, that is the subtitle of the book, I make the point that the international monetary system actually has collapsed three times in the past 100 years, 1914, 1939, and again in 1971. So this does happen with some frequency. It seems to happen every 30 or 40 years. I'm not saying that, you know, it's been 40 years since the last one. I'm not saying that the system collapses like clockwork tomorrow. I'm just saying that investors shouldn't be surprised if it does.
All right, so from square one, I mean, you are not a big proponent of globalization, it would appear, from this book.
Well, I am a proponent of globalization with an important caveat, which is certain systems, and a lot of them, finance, trade, capital markets, are what physicists call complex systems. And complex systems have a certain dynamic, and they're prone to collapse once they reach a certain size and complexity and density. So there are a lot of benefits from globalization. There are a lot of benefits from innovations in finance. But if you make things too big and too dense, when I say dense, I just mean too interconnected, that where everything depends on everything else, and one small problem in any part of the system can collapse the entire house of cards. Once you get to that point, then it's just a matter of time, probably not a very long period of time, before you have the collapse. So what I say is, let's take the benefits of globalization, but let's also protect ourselves, for example, by breaking up the big banks. So you take J.P. Morgan as a good example. You know, I've been in the banking business for 35 years. When I started, J.P. Morgan was seven or eight different banks. Today, they're all merged into one. You know, in 2008, we heard all about too big to fail. Well, guess what? Since then, the biggest banks in the United States are bigger. They have a larger percentage of the total banking assets in the system, and their derivatives books are much bigger. So everything about too big to fail in 2008 is bigger and more dangerous today. So let's just do sensible things like break up the banks into components. That way, if one of them fails, that may be too bad for the stockholders, but it doesn't take down the entire system.
If you're calling for the breakups of big banks, I'm guessing you don't get invited to a lot of parties on Wall Street these days.
Well, I do, but it's interesting what people tell you privately that they won't say publicly. I've actually met with central bankers. I've met with a lot of regulators. I've been very fortunate to have been invited down to, you know, brief the Treasury, and I'm at the Pentagon, the intelligence community, and so forth. And what they tell you privately is very different from what they say publicly. But you're right; it's not a popular message. But you know, there's a reason for that. The systems that Wall Street is using to manage risk, and which are accepted by the regulators, really because they don't know any better, allow a lot more leverage than the right systems. When I say the right systems, if you apply complexity theory to what we have in financial services, you would be scared to death about what's happening, what's coming soon. But if you apply what they call value at risk, this is just a different methodology with a different degree distribution, you'd say it's all good. Well, that method, guess what? It allows larger leverage, bigger bonuses, so the bankers can take home more money personally. I understand why they favor that, but they're leaving the rest of the system holding the bag. So what I'm trying to do is use the right methodology, identify the risk correctly. And again, this is all discussed in my book, so readers can judge for themselves. But yeah, it's not popular on Wall Street because it would reduce their bonuses and reduce the leverage in the system.
So let me see if I understand this correctly. If you, as an individual or a small business owner, went to a bank and said, I want a loan, here's how leveraged I am, this is my, you know, debt-to-asset ratio and everything, they probably would deny you the loan, but the same financial institution can take much greater leveraging and risk upon themselves.
That's exactly right. Let's just take a very simple example. So right now, a 10-year Treasury note yields about 2.5%. You know, it bounces around a little bit, but it's about 2.5%. So, and the banks don't have to provide any capital against that because it has a so-called risk weighting of zero. So I'm a bank, so I go out and buy treasury notes, 10-year treasury notes with borrowed money. Now, what am I paying my depositors for the borrowed money? Close to zero. I'm paying them about 25 basis points or 0.25%. So now I buy the 10-year note. It yields 2.5%. I'm paying, you know, 25 basis points, which is next to nothing to my depositors. So I'm making 2.25% holding that trade. And now I leverage it 10 to 1. So now I have almost a 25% return on equity because of the leverage. So I'm making a lot of money, and there's no risk, there's no credit risk in the trade. So the banks are incented to buy treasury debt, but not to make loans.
Much more to talk about with James Rickards. His book is The Death of Money, The Coming Collapse of the International Monetary System. Some compelling arguments in here. We'll talk about those, and you can join the discussion on the exchange when we return in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is James Rickards, a lawyer with a long history in the financial business, including more than three decades on Wall Street. He's written a second book about the issues he sees with the world financial system. This one is called The Death of Money, The Coming Collapse of the International Monetary System. He's already said he thinks that the banks should be broken up, so they're not in that too-big-to-fail category anymore. You can join us on the exchange as we go through the arguments he makes in his book. Phone number is here, 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Back to the too-big-to-fail concept. The understanding that appears to emerge from what happened with the Great Recession was that we were saying banks like, for example, Washington Mutual were too big to fail, but then we ended up making bigger banks take them over and becoming huge banks, like Chase.
Well, that's exactly right. And not only are the banks bigger, but if you look at what's, first of all, on their books, but also what's off the books, these are, you know, the derivatives, the so-called swaps and so forth.
The toxic assets.
On the financial statement. Those are even bigger. And this is exactly the problem. Now, what should have happened in 2008? These banks were failing sequentially. So you go back to March 2008, Bear Stearns failed. Summer 2008, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac failed. September 2008, Lehman failed, then AIG. The banks were failing one after the other. Morgan Stanley was days away from collapse. Goldman Sachs would have been right behind it, then Citibank and so forth. All these banks would have failed. Maybe J.P. Morgan would have been left standing, but maybe not. Now, what happened is the government came in and truncated that with tens of billions of dollars of money printing, asset swaps, guarantees. I meant to say trillions. Tens of trillions of dollars of guarantees and so forth. And, yeah, they propped up the system. But what do we have today? We're in a depression. We have no growth. Labor force participation is collapsing. The economy is in awful shape. Over 50 million on food stamps, over 11 million on disability, which is kind of the new form of unemployment. So the economy is in terrible shape. If at the time we had allowed the banks to collapse, which we should have done, it could have been done in a managed way. So all you do is the government nationalizes the banks, wipes out the stockholders, says to the bondholders, hey, you're going to have a loss here. We have to figure out how much it is. We don't know, but you're going to take a loss. But you protect the depositors. You guarantee the contractual counterparties. You strip out the bad assets, put them in a trust for the taxpayers, and then you IPO the clean bank. So now you've got clean banks out there that are not owned by the government that can start making loans. Instead, we propped up a rotten system, a lot of cronyism, a lot of people helping out their friends. Those banks are still around, but they're paralyzed. They've got a lot of the bad debts are still on the books. The same management and competent management is in place, et cetera. So it's not surprising we don't have any growth because we've taken a rotten banking system and frozen it in amber, which is what the Japanese did. They don't have any growth either, instead of sort of cleaning out the rot and coming up with a new clean banking system.
But you say we're in a depression now, but I mean, yep. Granted, the economic growth is not spectacular by any measure, but it's still growth, isn't it?
Well, that's the point. A lot of people, Jeffrey, don't understand what a depression is. They think it means continuous declining GDP. But that's not the definition. The definition of a depression is you can have growth in a depression. You know, the Great Depression went from 1929 to 1940, but we had very good growth from 1933 to 1936. So you can have growth in a depression, but it's below trend growth, and that's the key point. The United States' long-term trend is about 3.5% growth. That's the most a large economy like the U.S. can grow. But in the short run, you can grow more than that. You can grow 5.5-6% as people come back into the labor force, and those labor factors, you know, increase faster than population growth. So our tendency is 3.5%. Our short-term potential is 5.5-6%. We're growing at about 1-2%. So it's the gap between the 2% and the 3.5%. That's the depression. In other words, it's depressed growth. And by the way, that's not my definition. That's John Maynard Keynes' definition. I use it. I think it's the right definition. And the gap grows bigger over time, and that gap represents lost wealth. You never make it back. You might get back to trend at best, but you never make up the lost wealth. So that's what a depression is. It doesn't mean no growth. It means below trend growth because of bad public policy. So that is what we're in. We've been in it since 2007. We're going to stay in it indefinitely. This depression might go on for 10 years or more if we don't have some structural policy changes.
James Rickards, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Death of Money, The Coming Collapse of the International Monetary System. So let's talk about the monetary system as it currently exists. You're not a fan of paper money, at least paper money not backed by something, right?
Well, you can have a paper money system that works. I actually favor a strong dollar. You know, I write about gold a lot, and I talk about gold a lot, and I've put out specifications for a gold-backed system, but I'm not a gold bug. I actually favor a strong dollar, which is what we had from 1980 to 2010. That was the kind of king dollar or strong dollar period. You can have a paper money system, but you have to be responsible about it. You have to manage it carefully. And when people say the dollar's not backed by anything, it actually is backed by one thing, which is confidence. In other words, if people have confidence in the system, it can work fine. The problem is that confidence is fragile. It can be lost very easily, and it's very hard to regain. And my problem is that the Federal Reserve is using these models which don't correspond to reality. They're printing so much money that they're on the verge of destroying confidence in the dollar. So when I talk about the collapse of the dollar, what I mean by that is the collapse of confidence in the dollar as a store of value. And then people will go looking for something else. I mean, people aren't stupid. I like to say when it comes to your own money, everybody has a PhD. So people will get into, you know, land, hard assets, gold, silver, fine art, really anything other than they'll take the paper money, dump it, and get into these other things. So the Fed is destroying confidence, and that's really the collapse. So I recommend gold to investors, not a lot. I recommend 10%. I think that's the right amount. But that'll be your kind of your insurance policy when this dollar collapse comes.
10% of your net worth?
10% of your investable assets. When I say investable assets, you know, take your business and your home equity, put that to one side, and say, and what's left? So this is your stocks, your bonds, basically your portfolio, excluding your house and, say, your small business. Those are your investable assets. Put 10% of that in gold, not 50%, not all in. It'll serve you very well. When the inflation comes, that'll be your insurance policy. And if inflation doesn't come quickly, I mean, actually, gold does well in deflation, believe it or not. You know, during the Great Depression, the longest period of sustained deflation in American history, gold went up 75%. So gold does well in inflation and deflation, and having 10%, it's like having fire insurance on your house. You don't want your house to burn down, but heaven forbid, if it does, you're sure glad you have the insurance. So that's the role of gold.
When you talk, Jim, about the dollar being backed by confidence, I mean, it can't be just domestic confidence. I mean, the fact is the reason the dollar is still used as the currency by which all others are measured, it means that the world has confidence in it too, right?
Well, that's exactly right, but that's a two-edged sword because, yes, the world has confidence up to a point, but the world can lose confidence. This is one of the differences between, and by the way, that's happening, we can talk about that, but this is one of the differences between the U.S. and Japan. I mean, on paper, Japan is a basket case. They have a 200% debt-to-GDP ratio, which is far worse than Greece. Their economy's been in a depression since the early 1990s. They've got the worst demographic of any major economy in the world. So there are a lot of things that are wrong with Japan, but they mostly owe the debt to themselves. The Japanese government debt is owned by the Japanese. So it's like they're all in the lifeboat together. They're surrounded by sharks, but they're all in the lifeboat together. So as long as they have confidence in themselves, it's not a problem. But when you go to U.S. debt, it's a very different picture. We have about $17 trillion of U.S. debt outstanding, U.S. Treasury debt. A very large percentage of that is owned by the Russians, the Chinese, and other powers who don't necessarily wish us well, or even if they're our allies, they could lose confidence as well. Now, very interesting development. Vladimir Putin is going to Shanghai tonight. Tomorrow and the next day, he's going to conclude the largest energy deal in the history of the world. It's a 30-year contract with the Chinese to supply them with natural gas. The dollar is not part of that deal. The pricing of that deal will be in Chinese yuan and Russian rubles. There'll be other bilateral trading relationships that emerge from that. The Russians will be able to sell weapons and nuclear power plant technology to the Chinese, as well as natural resources. And there's a heck of a lot the Chinese can sell to the Russians. So that's a good example of two powers who have a lot of treasury debt who are moving away from the dollar. And that's what I mean by the collapse of confidence.
James Rickards, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Death of Money, The Coming Collapse of the International Monetary System. You can join this discussion on the exchange about where things stand and where we're likely to end up, at least in the near future. 800-838-3760, our phone number across the region in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Here is Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with James Rickards.
Hi, you all. Thanks for the scary information. You know, one part of me thinking about economic growth, it also reminds me of cancer being a growth. And I think on this finite planet, we have to be really careful not to just keep taking from the earth. But James, I would like to have your opinion on this economic scenario I've put forth on the exchange several times. What if the Lane County commissioners, who are soon to be reelected, and hopefully we'll have some progressive people there. Come on, Kevin Matthews, let's go. What if they decide to create a different currency, kind of like monopoly money? Let's call them hemps. Have it be based on the average price of industrial hemp. Let's see, the price per ton, that would be our gold standard. And let's say we gave every citizen, infant to elder, $1 million worth of hemps, with the whole point being that to win the game, we all win the game, everybody in the watershed, everyone in Lane County, and the whole state could do this, everyone in Lane County would be okay. They would be housed. We would encourage people to use their hemps to start entrepreneurial businesses, cottage industries, creating services and products in a sustainable manner, in using materials from the Lane County watershed to create products and services to take care of ourselves, and including Bambi out there in the woods and the cougars. Anyway,
all right, so
I think
local
it's
currency.
Legal to do this. I would like your opinion as to localities taking care of their economic needs, kind of like villages used to do.
Sure.
Right. Thanks, Skeeter.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Skeeter, it's a very interesting idea. And first of all, I'll make the point, anything can be a currency. And throughout history, for example, clamshells have been currency. Feathers have been currency. We all know about the gold standard. And right now, paper money is currency. So the idea that something else can be a currency is absolutely historically correct. As far as going down to the localities, something like that may happen. If the central system collapses, which is what I'm talking about in my book, maybe the central authorities can reestablish that with executive orders and neo-fascism. Maybe they try to reestablish confidence with gold, because historically people have had confidence in gold. But if all that fails, I do expect not so much revolution, but devolution. Devolution is when power passes to localities. You know, it could be Texas or Oregon. They could even have different standards. So it's certainly possible. It's happened in history. I remember when I was a little kid, my dad, who grew up in the Depression, he saved a wooden nickel. Money was so scarce in the Depression that some towns made what they call wooden nickels, and, you know, you would accept it from a local merchant, and you would hand it to the next guy. So the answer is anything can be money, and devolution to localities will actually happen if central authority collapses, which it might if they continue to abuse their monetary power.
Let's take another call. Here's Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with James Rickards, the author of The Death of Money.
Good morning, Mr. Rickards. You remind me an awful lot of a guy I used to hate, and that was Simon Johnson. The problem was he was right.
Well, here's the thing, Paul. There are insiders, right? So there are people who work at the Treasury and the International Monetary Fund and the Federal Reserve, and they've got all the PhDs and they understand all of that. Then there's kind of everybody else who is, you know, trying to take care of the families, the retirement, the, you know, aging parents, kids going to college, you know, so forth. And these elites, as I call them, and it's not like a deep, dark conspiracy. I mean, they're real people. That they're, you know who they are. They're Treasury secretaries and boards of governors and professors and all that. These elites just kind of say, hey, don't bother us. We know what we're doing, et cetera. Well, I'm in an opposition, and Simon is too. I'm glad you mentioned Simon Johnson. There are a few others where I've got the training, I've got the university degrees, I've got the experience of having been inside all those institutions. I gave an address at the World Bank last week. I've been invited in to give private briefings to the Treasury. I've had private dinners, just eight people around the table with central bank governors. So I do have all that kind of access and expertise, and yet I don't consider myself one of those outsiders, even though I come and go. My books are written in plain English. That doesn't mean they're dumbed down at all. They are not dumbed down. It's a very high level, but I do just talk to the reader in plain English. There's no reason to use all that jargon. So there are a small number of people who have the expertise to tell you what's going on, but actually do it, as they say, in plain English. You know, the professors always write for each other, and Simon's one of them. So I think it's very, if I may compliment you, very astute to kind of to pick up the similarity there. But, yeah, I'm one of the few people who does not work at the IMF who actually understands what the IMF does, and that's the kind of thing I talk about in my books.
And the other part of Paul's point was the question about how do we protect ourselves from what could be coming.
Well, that's right. And, you know, again, I hate to sound like a broken record, but the 10% gold is your insurance policy. And by the way, I recommend physical gold, so coins or bullion. And when, you know, when the collapse of the international monetary system comes, as I say, it has happened a number of times. This is not a far-fetched estimate. It doesn't mean the end of the world. It doesn't mean we all go live in caves and eat canned goods. What it does mean is that the major financial trading powers get together and sit around the table, and they rewrite what are called the rules of the game. And the rules of the game is not my phrase. That phrase has been around for 100 years. It's basically the operating system of the international monetary system. And when that happens, either gold will play an important part, or if it doesn't, the solution of printing world money from the International Monetary Fund will be highly inflationary. So gold is going to protect you. Gold is not digital. You can't wipe it out. You can't hack it. You know, it's not going to disappear the way Bitcoin occasionally does. I'm not a Bitcoin basher, but it is very vulnerable. You know, if the internet and the power grid fail, your gold is still gold. You know, it's still good. So I do recommend that 10% allocation to help people.
Come back then to the issue of who owns the debt. You pointed out that in Japan's case, their debt to GDP ratio is far worse than even Greece, but at least it's money they owe to themselves. The $17 trillion of U.S. debt is owned, among other parties, by China and Russia. But how could this be used against us? And particularly, how could it be used to create a problem in the world economy that wouldn't also affect Russia and China?
Well, very easily, and I talk about this in Chapter 2 of my new book, The Death of Money, where I talk about financial warfare. For example, by the way, you know, I'm involved in this and I write about it, but you don't have to take it from me. Hank Paulson, who is Secretary of the Treasury, recently gave an interview at the BBC, and I believe this is in his book also, and he tells a story. In 2008, at the absolute depths of the crisis, he called the Chinese leadership to let them know, because, you know, remember, the Congress voted down the TARP on the first vote. It looked right, like the whole thing was going to collapse, but they came back a couple days later, and they passed it. And Hank Paulson called the Chinese leadership and said, look, don't worry about it. We got to deal with the Congress. You know, I know it's hard for outsiders to understand, but we'll get this done. At that point, the Chinese leadership said to him, you know, we just got a call from the Russians, who owned a lot of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac debt. And they said, why don't we dump that debt and kind of drive the United States under? Now, the Chinese didn't do that. It was just a conversation between the two. But that's a real-world example coming from no less a source than the Secretary of the Treasury about the potential for that kind of harm. And when people say, how could you do it without hurting themselves? Well, it is true that if Russia and China started dumping securities, that might hurt their own portfolio. But war always has costs. I mean, aircraft carriers cost money. Tanks cost money. Wars cost money. So the idea that you might have some portfolio costs, too many U.S. analysts and policymakers are acting like CEOs. They're not CEOs. They're political leaders. And sometimes countries will play a negative-sum game, which means that everybody loses, but you lose more than they do. And then they say, I won, because you lost more. And so you can't think of everything in terms of wealth maximization. You have to think of it in terms of power maximization.
But here again, their power ends up diluted in a place like China if they are then declaring financial war on the country that buys most of their stuff.
Well, it depends how much harm they do to us. I'm not saying they would do this lightly. Imagine the Chinese are invading Taiwan, and the president's going to send in the Seventh Fleet to interdict the invasion. And the Chinese president calls the U.S. president and says, if you act, we will shut down the New York Stock Exchange with our hackers and destroy your economy. What are you going to do? The president might back off, and no one would ever know.
All right. Much to talk about financial war and the forms it could take. Jim Rickard's book is The Death of Money, The Coming Collapse of the International Monetary System. Much more to talk about. We have some phone calls waiting. We'll take those when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is James Rickards, a lawyer with a long history in the financial business that includes more than three decades on Wall Street. He is now out with his second book. His first one was called Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis. The theme seems to be continued in his latest book, The Death of Money, The Coming Collapse of the International Monetary System. You can join this discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So this second chapter in the book about the concept of financial war, we broached the subject a moment ago. You say, among other things, that a hedge fund is a perfect cover for an intelligence operation. How's that?
Well, I have a lot of experience in hedge funds, and I have a lot of experience with working with the intelligence community. And my experience is they're very similar in terms of their goals and methods. And what I mean by that is they're both information gathering organizations. A hedge fund makes money by having better information than the next hedge fund or Wall Street. An intelligence service does its job by getting better information than anyone else. So they're both out there gathering information from numerous sources. Initially they start out kind of the same. Now, hedge funds are trying to make money, and intelligence services are trying to help with national security, but they're set up, they're secret. They have various operational security measures. They're information gathering organizations. They can use deception in various ways. So, as I say, they're very, very similar culturally. So I make the point that you could take a hedge fund and turn it into a real intelligence operation, set it up, give it some, anodyne name, put it in a place like the Cayman Islands, have the owners of some trust in Switzerland, use what's called layering, where you have multiple front organizations, each one owning the other, so it's very difficult to trace it all the way back to the source. And a country like China, which has $4 trillion in reserves and trillions of dollars in its sovereign wealth funds, could take some of that money, even a few billion dollars, put it into these covert hedge funds, and then they could just trade normally, buy and sell the same stuff all day. You wouldn't make or lose any money, but that wouldn't be the point. The point would be just to be active in the markets, gain the trust of securities firms, gain the trust of exchanges, and then one day, in coordination from around the world, suddenly engage in a massive dumping operation, sell Apple, sell Google, et cetera. And by the way, you wouldn't do it on a quiet day. You would do it on a day when the market was already down 4 or 5%. You would try to push it down 20%, which is what happened on October 19, 1987. I'm not saying that was a covert operation. I'm saying that that was a day when the market went down 22% in a single day. For example, in today's terms, that 1987 crash, that would be the equivalent of 4,000 Dow points. Not 400, but 4,000. That's what a 25% drop looks like. That's what happened in 1987. So you could manipulate markets using these covert sleeper-style hedge funds. It would, you'd need some corrupt lawyers and accountants to play along. They're not hard to find. You'd have a lot of unwitting accomplices, in the accounting and legal administration professions, et cetera. But it could be very easily done. But there's an even easier way to do that, which I talked about in the book, which is just cyber financial warfare. We all know about cyber threats, and I've been talking about financial threats. Imagine the combination of the two, where you use cyber means to engage in financial warfare, hacking into the New York Stock Exchange, putting in spoof sell orders, not real ones coming from a hedge fund, but computer-generated that would be perceived as real at the same time and, again, drive the markets under. This is the future of financial warfare. And for people who say this is far-fetched, I would point out that, August 22nd, 2013, the NASDAQ was closed for half a day. We've never had a credible explanation as to what happened there. Was it Syrian hackers, Iranian hackers, Russian hackers? If it was a technical glitch, they should have told us. And if it was hacking, there's good reason why they haven't told us, because it would spook markets around the world. So this is going on whether we like it or not.
Let's take another call. Here's Michael in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with James Rickards, the author of The Death of Money.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. Back in 2006, I believe the Federal Reserve announced there would be no more forthcoming Money 3 reports. As far as my knowledge goes, Money 3 is the money man's money, the big boy's money, the money that just makes money, as opposed to Money 1 and 2, which are dependent in so many levels on the development of goods and services. I should have been a red flag back then. I followed it a little bit. But I've come to the conclusion that the corrosive effect of Money 3 on our economy, you've touched on it on point, but if you could talk a little bit more about how to get back to Money 1 and Money 2, depending on what value you'd like to apply to it. And I'd like to hear your explanation on that point. I'll take my answer off the air, and thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Yep, sure, Paul. I mean, what you're talking about are the so-called M's, and of course, M is for money, and it surprises a lot of people to know that there are different definitions of money. They think, hey, money is money, it's a dollar bill in my pocket, but as the Fed sees it, there's a whole series. There's what's called M0. That's the base money that the Fed actually prints. And then there's M1. That's the money that the banks create. So they take the base money from the Fed, and they lend it out, and then you get the loan, and you put it back in the bank in your checking account, and they make another loan, and they leverage it up. So that's M1. M2, you start to throw in things like commercial paper and traveler's checks, et cetera, and then M3. And so M3 adds other financial-type instruments that are close to cash equivalent. So depending on how you define it, you know, each one of those is kind of a broader base than the one before. And you're right, they did discontinue that M3 series. By the way, that's part of a long-standing government pattern of changing, moving the goalposts. You know, they've redefined what unemployment is. They've redefined what inflation is. There's a fellow named John Williams who has a service called Shadow Stats or Shadow Statistics. He goes back and looks at today's data. If you use the old definitions, the ones we had in the 80s and 90s, when you do that, by the way, things are far worse than the government's telling us. You know, unemployment's higher, inflation is higher, et cetera. But leaving that to one side and getting back specifically to your question, here's the problem in the economy today. The Fed can make M0 whatever they want. That's their direct money printing operation. They can make it whatever they want. But in order to drive the economy forward, you have to have turnover. The technical name for that is velocity. If I go out to dinner and I tip the waiter and the waiter takes a taxi cab home and the taxi driver puts some gas in his car, that my dollar has velocity of 3 because there were $3 of goods and services, you know, the tip, the taxi, and the gas. But if I stay home and watch TV, my money has velocity of 0 because I didn't spend any money. And the problem with the economy today is not the Fed money printing, it's the fact that there's no velocity. People are staying home. So the Fed has to lie to us, try to get us out there lending and spending again. And you're right, you know, people talk about commercial loans of banks going up. Well, the only reason they're going up is for, you know, stock buybacks, dividends, and M&A activity. None of that is productive. It enriches the bankers, I understand that. It might enrich some stockholders, but it doesn't do anything for the productive economy. The way you drive an economy forward is with, you know, loans that are being put to good use for entrepreneurs, small businesses, working capital loans. That's the kind of money that grows the economy. But the big boy loans, you know, for M&A activity, dividends and stock buybacks for companies that are keeping their cash offshore and only have to borrow the money because they want to pay a dividend, but they don't want to bring the offshore money back because they have to pay tax on it. That's the kind of games and financial engineering that are going on. That's not doing the economy any good at all.
M&A, mergers and acquisitions?
I'm sorry,
said M&A. You're talking about mergers and acquisitions?
Yeah. Now, these mergers and acquisitions are huge. They have to be financed. But, you know, when Company A buys Company B, that doesn't create goods and services. I mean, I'm not making new widgets. I don't have a new invention. I don't have new technology. I'm not going to Walmart. That's just financial engineering. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but that's the only thing that we're getting. By the way, there are a lot of academic studies that show that most merger and acquisition activity actually destroys wealth rather than creates wealth. Look at the Time Warner. You know, when Warner and Time Magazine merged, that practically wiped out stockholders. That was one of the biggest losses of wealth ever. So most of the M&A activity, which is what the banks are financing these days, destroys wealth. We're not getting the money into productive channels, which is what we need. But there's reasons for that having to do with the fact that we're in a depression.
Let's take another call. We have Steve and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with James Rickards. His book is The Death of Money.
Hello.
Hi.
You've been talking about it for the last 10 minutes or so with financial warfare and all of that. And I have, in writings that I've done in the last few years, I've been referring to an economic world war that I think that's been going on for at least 15 years. It's never talked about in the press. And I think we're in great danger because we don't talk about it. And you're talking about it all over the place right here and now. The fact that there are geographic nations at war, but also virtual nations, multinational corporations that really are not at all loyal to any particular nation in some cases. And the thing that you touched on that just sort of went by, the agreement between China and Russia, where they're not using the dollar in their transaction, and that speaks of what many people are describing, that the loss of the dollar as the international reserve currency and the implications that will have for the United States. Anyway, why do we not use the term economic world war? Because it seems like it's appropriate. Please comment. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for that, Steve.
Sure. I hope readers are interested in my new book, The Death of Money, but you might be interested in my first book, Currency Wars, came out a few years ago. But in the first two chapters of Currency Wars, I talk about a financial war game conducted by the Pentagon at a top-secret weapons laboratory just outside of Washington. I was asked by the Pentagon to be one of the game designers and facilitators, and I also participated in the game. So I described what happened there. Just to your point, in a war game you have cells, which are the teams, So we had a red cell, a green cell, and a blue cell, and that could be the United States and Russia and China. But we also had a cell for hedge funds and banks. So it's exactly what you were describing, which is the players are not just countries. They include financial institutions, hedge funds, and other large players. So that's number one. Number two, we played it out over a couple of days, and we had a scenario in which Russia and China pooled their gold resources, put it in a vault in Switzerland, created a bank in London, issued a new gold-backed currency, and said, from now on, if you want Russian natural resource exports or Chinese manufactured goods, you have to pay for it in this new money. So the idea was they would completely turn their back on the dollar. We were actually laughed at by some of the Harvard eggheads, when we did it. But since then, since 2009, Russia has increased its gold reserves by 70%. China has increased its gold reserves by several 100%. And now China and Russia are getting together tomorrow in Shanghai to conclude an energy deal where the dollar is not invited. So the world is actually playing out the way we warned the Pentagon in 2009. This is real stuff. It's not, a Tom Clancy fantasy. This actually happened. It's all in my first book, Currency Wars. And I talk about it more in the new book and update the story in my new book, The Death of Money. So you're exactly right. And, the big picture is really the petrodollar. And that goes back to at least the mid-70s. But you can even take it back to the 1940s when Franklin Delano Roosevelt met with King Saud of Saudi Arabia, the founder of the Saudi Arabian dynasty. But we stabbed the Saudis in the back by having detente with the Iranians last December. And the deal with the Saudis is they would price oil in dollars, which meant that everyone needed dollars, but we would guarantee their national security. Well, we pulled the rug out from under their national security, so the next move may be for them to pull the rug out from under the dollar. So these are all very important things. They're happening today. Again, this is not kind of a five-year forecast. These things are all happening today, and I do talk about them in my book.
Final call here from Dennis and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jim Rickards. His book is The Death of Money.
Yeah, I've been listening to this, and I think it's all real interesting and scary and something that we can talk about, but I don't think it makes a damn bit of difference in my life. I'm just a guy who lives here in America, and it's gone up, it's went down, I've been rich, I've been poor, and I'm just going to live and do whatever I have to do to survive. And what this guy is explaining is a bunch of financial mumbo-jumbo that rich guys like to talk about and play games with.
All right, let's convert it to a more accessible level then, Dennis. Thanks
sure.
for that. Appreciate it. So you said the book is written in plain English. It is a pretty easy read, I'll give you that. So, but for somebody who doesn't have a big portfolio or the ability to convert a lot of their investable assets, what do you do?
Well, here's the thing, Dennis. Dennis and Jeffrey, I actually don't worry about the hedge funds, the billionaires, and the big banks. I know them all personally, not all of them. I know a lot of them personally, but I don't worry about them. They can take care of themselves. By the way, Warren Buffett is out dumping paper money. He bought a railroad. He bought oil. He bought natural gas. He's getting in hard assets as fast as he can. My book is actually written for everyday Americans. I'll give you a concrete example. From 1977 to 1981, not that long ago, that five-year period, inflation in the United States was 50%. The value of the dollar was cut in half. So if you're an everyday American, so you have a pension, an insurance policy, an annuity, money in the bank, any kind of fixed retirement income, and we get that kind of inflation, you've lost half. You're wiped out. So the big guys can absolutely take care of themselves, and they are, by the way. I know I live a couple towns away from Greenwich, Connecticut. I know people with vaults in their homes with hundreds of millions of dollars of gold bars. They'll be fine. My book is written for the everyday American. Even if you just have a pension, insurance policy, annuity, or money in the bank, we get the kind of inflation we saw not that long ago, which I do see coming, you're going to be wiped out. So it does affect everyday Americans.
All right. At that, we will close the discussion. The book is called The Death of Money, The Coming Collapse of the International Monetary System. We could probably talk for another hour, but that's the only one we have. Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Good to have you. That'll do it for today's Jefferson Exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. We also provide show topics and recordings on our Facebook page with the same links available on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, The Takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, we'll be followed by news from the BBC. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about six sea lions showing up along the West Coast. At 8:30, we'll talk about the issue with starfish wasting disease, what's happening to sea stars. Then at 9 o'clock, we'll have a discussion about alternative energy and how it is being used in our local regions. All that tomorrow on The Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duran. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of The Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.